You are listening to the weekly Cybersecurity Podcast, episode 22, summarizing security news and items of interest for the week ending the 28th of October, 2016. So let's get started. I'm Brendan from the ABSH Group in Australia, your host for this episode, and I'm joined by Stuart from Velocity in Hong Kong. If this is your first time listening, thanks for coming. Our aim is to produce this every week. Come back often and feel free to add this to your favorite podcast. A welcome to you, Stuart.
Thank you. It's been an interesting week. There's certainly been some news around Windows again, which is a little unfortunate. One of these dates back to, I believe, Windows version 1, which is which makes it, what, a 20-year-old vulnerability or something?
It's like having God mode. You know, like it's one of those game hacks where you just become completely invincible, bypassing everything you want. So, of course, you're referring to the new code injection method that was found in Windows, and unfortunately exposes the entire Windows suite.
Indeed, this was a cybersecurity research company in Silo that found this, and it's actually making use of a Windows feature called the Atom Tables, and is actually not something that Microsoft can patch, which what makes this a really sort of interesting dangerous thing. I mean, there are some mitigations around this. Basically, the Atom Tables are used to store strings for cross-process and cross-application communications. Basically this particular researcher found out how to leverage that in order to store executable code in the Atom tables and then use another process, potentially with different privileges, to actually then call it and execute it. So it's being discussed with great interest around the security community.
Yeah, without a doubt. So just to simplify that a little bit, it's basically applications, so you know, Microsoft Word or Excel or the antivirus software and the actual Windows operating itself. You're saying, you know, stores data in a database somewhere in Windows called an Atom table, and this guy's figured out how to actually edit that table so that when those applications call the data from the table, which they assume is safe and good and friendly, it's not, and it allows it to compromise the application and then force that application to do bad things.
Pretty much. I mean, one of the mitigations basically is you still have to have either a what we would call a malicious application installed on Windows in the first place. So this comes back to making sure you only install things that you really need. Or secondly, it can also be used by your typical attack vectors like a buffer overrun. But it does mean that sort of the buffer overruns have now a method to get around some of the other security measures that are built into Windows. Mm-hmm. ASLR, which is the address space randomization, which is something that I'm not going to go into in detail here, but has helped a lot with preventing malicious code from doing things, you know, like when you visit a website or that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So I mean, this is not the first code injection technique. So they have, you know, AV vendors and things have mitigated this in the past. It's just damaging because it's been previously unknown, correct? So that's...
Yeah, I mean, that's what it comes down to. I mean, the difficulty is going to be, I mean, obviously watch this space, but because certainly we would expect antivirus and anti-malware vendors now to try and hook into the operating system on the Atom tables and monitor what comes in and out of that. But the difficulty there, of course, is we're going to come back to sort of a heuristic space or a signature-based system, which is not going to catch necessarily everything, you know, particularly when you look at what the bad guys are doing these days with, you know, just constantly changing code that literally can be different from literally every single installation or infection that they run. So it's going to make it kind of difficult for that. And then, of course, the other thing, of course, this is a feature of Windows, and there are a lot of, the vast majority of major applications actually make use of this. So Microsoft can't turn around and just turn this off. And unfortunately, this is a feature that's been inherited since the very earliest days of Windows, when, of course, they didn't it wasn't designed with security in mind. So this is very much a legacy issue that is unfortunately coming back to bite Microsoft.
Trying to retrofit, eh?
Yeah, it's sort of like, you know, there's a big highway there where you want to allow certain types of cars through, but you know, you can drive around the gate.
Yeah, yeah. I don't pay the toll, I'll just drive around it, that old chestnut. Yeah. And not the only vulnerability for the week, actually, there's quite a number of vulnerabilities, but Apple, interestingly, code execution vulnerability in iOS, that's exploited via a JPEG file, rather crafty and interesting. They also issued a round of patches for the macOS Sierra and fixes for vulnerabilities in Safari's web browser, the Apple Watch and the Apple TV.
I actually haven't looked in this in great detail yet, but my guess would be that this is a parsing issue, and this is where they interpret the sort of the file that they get, and there must be sort of a buffer overrun and whatever they're using to do this that then enables a code that's been added onto the end to then be exploited. Now, of course, the tricky thing with something like a JPEG file, which is what particularly the iOS vulnerability is around, is that literally someone can just send you a picture in an email, they could MMS you, they can, you know, any way that they can get an image to you on your phone. You know, there's just so many ways. It could be on Facebook. I mean, there's all sorts of ways that, you know, this could be exploited.
Yeah. Deal it up so through the advertising and websites.
Deal it up through the advertising, any of these kinds of things, which just makes it such a nasty issue.
Again, that's almost a master key, right? I mean,
pretty much, yes. I mean, if you can then leverage that to jailbreak the phone or to, you know, get root access, for example, you know, you've pretty much to, you know, as you say, God mode.
Mm-hmm. And there was no response from Apple either as to whether it's been exploited publicly and it's in the wild, or whether it's just something that they have identified or somebody in the security industry identified and notified them about. So interesting.
Yeah, typically a security researcher would come out and say, oh yeah, that was me that found this, if it was a security researcher. So it either means that it has been seen in the wild and Apple's caught onto it, or maybe it's been, you know, maybe it just hasn't been a public announcement around whoever's done it yet.
That would be if they did sell it, that would be $1 million exploit, wouldn't it?
1.5 million, I believe.
1.5 million. Yes, and we haven't hit the news about anyone winning $1.5 million, so I'm guessing it's probably a security researcher or Apple themselves.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed, anyway.
Fingers crossed. Yeah.
And Joomla this week. Joomla, obviously, a very, well, not a super popular, but certainly in the day, in the past, has been a very popular CMS, content management system for the web. So for those that are kind of new, you know, it's an equivalent to things like WordPress. And just quietly released two fixes in their 3.6.4 version that nastily led to account creation and elevated privileges. Huge exploit. Like, basically, it impacts versions of Joomla from 3.4.4 to 3.6.3, but it basically allows a user to register as a new user even if that user has been disabled in the past. And the elevated privilege bug allowed a new user to register on the site and get elevated privileges. So, you know, you sign up on the site, but you get admin privileges.
Yeah. We actually had some personal news. When I say personal news, company news around this. We have one client that uses Joomla for their website, and their website was getting hammered brute force attempts on the login.
Yeah.
So it was. We ended up having to we put in a rule to restrict IP access to the login page.
Yeah, yeah, that's certainly one of the best ways to do it, or enable two-factor authentication. Although, in this update, there is actually a fix to the two-factor authentication, because when you enabled it, there was an error in version 3.6.3. So, I guess recommendations on the Joomla side, definitely update if you're running 3.6.3 or previous versions. So you want to be on 3.6.4. Like you said, some geo IP blocking or locking down the login page to just your IP or your developer's IP is another great way of saving or securing the site. Running daily or nightly AV scans on the site's also good to pick up any kind of malicious changes and any type of change management. So you can actually set tools up to monitor your HTML and your database and stuff, and kind of learn what normal changes are and what is unusual, so to speak, and give you a notification when it occurs, although that is taking it to the next level.
Indeed, definitely with all of these things, make sure you get the latest version. So same with the iOS and Windows and anything else that you actually have to be running.
And last vulnerability for the week, a major vulnerability found in the Schneider Electric Unity Pro software. Now, this is obviously probably not a lot of people in the industry would be aware of, unless you're in industrial controller land. You probably have never heard of it, but Schneider Electric create industrial controllers. So they're things that, turn. I guess power stations, different flows for water treatment plants and things like that. And they've found a bug in the actual management software that controls all those controllers. Allows a hacker to remotely execute code. So if you have the management software exposed to the internet, which you definitely should not, a hacker could potentially breach the software and allow themselves to switch on and switch off and change all the various controllers.
Yeah, one of the interesting things, of course, about this is that this would be very much a case of probably a targeted attack where someone is potentially doing industrial espionage or some kind of naughtiness. So if you can get inside, the network, even if it's not internet exposed, if you can get inside the network, even just on one machine, you can presumably then scan around for the Unity Pro and then
It's certainly a
significantly impact their operations.
a good example of why you want to put these types of tools on a separate subnet and lock down the access to just, the users that actually need to access it. No need to have the management software on the LAN when only a subset of those users need to have access to it.
Totally agree. I mean, it's a, it is, it is, and unfortunately, it is a very much a case of, people didn't worry about this in the past, and it's basically redesigning networks now to, either segment or even micro segment different areas.
I mean, it's scary. I mean, these industrial controllers, they manage things like, valves, turbines, centrifuges, smart meters. So you can do some, definitely do some damage with it. The only, I guess, saving grace in this instance, though, is they discovered the vulnerability 6 months ago. And it was privately disclosed, so it was done by security researchers, disclosed to Schneider, who then patched it. So you'd hope that it hasn't been actually exploited out there in the wild. But for those running the Schneider Electric Unity Pro software, you want to be on the latest one, 11.1. All previous versions are definitely susceptible to the vulnerability. So if you haven't done so already, definitely get onto it.
Exactly. In my university days, I actually worked at a couple of industrial plants where these kinds of things were actually in use. In one case, I think we had a kiln that was boiling off chemical fluids, which was operating at 200-300 degrees. You can imagine what messing around with industrial controllers on that might do.
Very, very scary. Anything really to do with fire or water or power, that you can tell the controller to do whatever you like and, potentially override sensors and stuff. It's just scary. But I guess it's also an avenue for terrorism too, and that's probably why it's even, that much more serious, and probably why it's such a nice target. But it's definitely targeted attack, right? I mean, the average common person probably doesn't have much to gain from this.
No, I definitely. But it could be, for example, an industrial style ransom attack. You know, where in your network you've got, you know, 24 hours to pay this, or we will destroy your equipment.
Yeah.
If we find any, you know, and if we already have stuff in there, so if we find any attempt to lock us out, then we will, it has a dead man switch on it or something like that. So, you know, but there are ways that people could use this kind of stuff to really cause trouble.
Yeah, I mean, it's another example, and I think it was last week we were talking on the podcast how it is concerning, and the one thing that does keep me up at night, and I think you were echoing, was the fact that technology now is so ingrained in our lives. It can actually be used to cause physical harm in terms of, I think last week we were talking about how the hospitals had to cancel surgeries. And that's because of a ransomware attack. Now that's having a direct impact on the well-being of our lives. And this is another classic example of that. So you know, it'd be nice if we had the whole security community as a, you know, as the most important piece, rather than flexibility, time to market, and all those other bits and pieces. But unfortunately, that's just not how the world works right at the moment.
Yep. And again, this is certainly another case of watch this space, because I'm sure we'll see more news around this kind of thing. It's not the first one we've even talked about just on this podcast in the last 6 months with industrial systems that are a problem.
Yeah. Moving on, we switch into the breach section, which I always hope is empty, but unfortunately, we keep having items in here. The biggest one, and obviously close to home for me, would be the Red Cross Blood Service data breach, and the largest in Australia. So they've just hit the record. They stole records of 550,000 blood donors. Now, I will just quickly correct that. There's reports in the news that it's the largest ever data leak, and it contains 1.3 million records, which is correct. The data that was stolen does create 1.3 million, but because some blood donors can donate more than once, they reckon there's only 550,000 unique records. Still, the largest in Australia, and unfortunately, it's not occurred because of you know, they haven't hacked the site or gotten around defences. It's just an unfortunate negligence, or someone's just unfortunately overlooked. They took a backup of the database and just accidentally published it publicly on the site, so it was just sitting there on the root, and a hacker's bot has goes out, they crawl the web looking for this type of thing, and they found the file and pulled it down, and the data was compromised. The it's certainly disappointing, and it's certainly not the first time this has happened. I remember 2012, 2013, Telstra did the same thing. They accidentally published the silent number list. So in Australia, if you have an old line phone, you could pay some more money per month, and you could have that number silent, so it wasn't published what your phone number was. And they published 15,775 customers' numbers, and they did it twice, which was less than ideal. But
so do you get your money back since they published it?
I don't know what happened. I know it was definitely investigated, and I know they got fined, but I don't know whether people did get their money back. It'd be interesting to find that out, actually. And obviously, you know, this is probably a little bit more damaging in terms of, you know, if they've got your phone number, it's annoying. You can probably really valuable to marketing companies and things like that. But in this instance, you know, these forms, they deal with health, and they contain really sensitive things, you know, like not just your name and your address, but also your age, your phone number, your date of birth, what blood type you are, whether you engage in any risky sexual behavior, whether you're pregnant. So, you know, you can imagine that this type of information is potentially damaging to those that have been exposed, and not just for the risk of blackmail, but also imagine you're a celebrity or someone that's in the public eye, and you don't want people to know that you're pregnant. Yeah, it's just it's disappointing, I guess. It's a lot of valuable data. It was compromised due to, I guess, negligence, really. And it, again, going back to what we were just talking about before, it impacts real world. Australians need 25,000 blood donations a week. You scare people by hacking the site that's trying to do something good. And people may not want to donate anymore. And that obviously impacts on the amount of supplies, and therefore potentially someone could miss out on a blood donation, which causes them to lose their life. So it's a disappointing hack on both fronts. One, that they've been targeted when they're trying to do something positive for humanity, and two, because it wasn't something that was hacked in a failure of technology or something that was done due to a vulnerability, but more just accidentally leaving data on the server.
Yeah, it is unfortunate that there's almost no line that won't be crossed on some of these things. I mean, the classic case, which you already mentioned earlier, was hospitals, for example, in the United States that got taken out by ransomware. And there are literally people with lives on the line because of these kinds of attacks, but obviously someone on the other side doesn't give a damn as long as they get their money.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, it's just... Yeah, it's an interesting world we live in. The other interesting piece, and testament to everything that we say in the podcast, that file, which was just a SQL backup file of the database, was published on the site on the 5th of September, and by the 25th of October, the data had been compromised. Yeah, that's 8 weeks. And it's no doubt that it was likely just, one of the hackers' bots that just sit there crawling, running HTTP GET requests and looking for directories and then scanning for files that end in .sql.
Indeed.
So I guess for those listening that have given blood and that are concerned, you can check whether your data was breached. Now, so let me just go back a step. First and foremost, it only impacts people that used the web form. So if you've gone into the blood donor, or you called them, or you didn't use their online form, then your data is safe. It's only the web form data. The web form data has been leaked between 2010 and 2016. You can confirm by going to the website haveibeenporn.com. That's haveibeenporn.com. Troy Hunt from Microsoft, the regional director, he runs that site, and he's uploaded the data in there so that you can go and search and work out whether you have been compromised. If you have, or if you want any more information, go to the Red Cross website. They have been quite transparent in the whole process, and there's a lot of information on there as to what they're doing about it and what you can do, and a number to contact them if you've got any further questions. For organizations that have web forms, this is not the first time I've seen a client's web form data get compromised. Once that web form inquiry has been submitted, ideally you want that information entered into your ERP or your CRM system and should be deleted off there. I know some people, and we do this to some extent, we have a cache of probably the last 5 days worth of forms, just in case something happens and that data doesn't get sent through so that we can resend it. But I guess make sure that you're not publishing that data publicly. B, it's no longer acceptable to simply protect the perimeter. There is no set and forget. You do need to be proactive on this stuff. You do need to have change control processes in place, and you need to be auditing. You need to be auditing your perimeters. You need to be auditing your web or your attack vectors. Just because they were safe yesterday doesn't mean that they're going to be safe tomorrow. So there does need to be a process, and ideally that process is some type of automated monitoring. There are lots of applications, and we're not going through them on this podcast, obviously, because there's a number of them, and it's going to depend on your specific circumstance. But organizations, they need to step it up. Yeah, they need to understand the security posture. You need to have a current inventory of your data assets, and you need to have processes in place that continuously test and monitor and ensure they're secure.
All good tips there, I think.
I guess last week or the last couple of weeks, moving on, we've been speaking about the massive Dyn attack. So that was Dyn DNS, the DNS provider that were hacked by the botnet, rumored to be the Mirari botnet and some other botnets as well. There was a suspicion, but it took them down for pretty much a good part of a whole day. They did suffer three attacks in total, and there's some more information now starting to surface. And Dyn are generally pretty good at doing a post-mortem. So what we know now is on the 28th of October at 7 a.m., which is 10 p.m. in Australia or 7 p.m. in Hong Kong, the first attack was targeted on their East Coast data centers. Dyn did well. You know, they mitigated that within a couple of hours. It did knock off certain services, but they were able to kind of resolve and bring services back online. On the same day at 12 p.m., it was the following day, so it's the 29th of October, 3 a.m. in Australia, and 29th of October, 12 a.m. in Hong Kong. The second attack, which hit now globally, so it hit both the east and west data centers, that was mitigated about an hour later. And then they had a third attack. Which was on the 28th again at 4 p.m. in the US, but Australia was again the 29th at 7 a.m. and Hong Kong 7 a.m. Sorry, that shouldn't be 7. That would be 3 a.m. Hong Kong on the 28th.
4 a.m.
4 a.m. Sorry,
4 a.m.
4 a.m. Hong Kong would be the third attack. But that attack there was actually no impact. Dyn were able to basically absorb that. That data, sure, to at a high cost. They have confirmed the source of the attack was routers infected with the Mirai botnet. It was sophisticated. It was highly distributed. It involved tens of millions of unique IP addresses. They're yet to confirm the reports that the hacktivist group Anonymous and the other group New World Hackers are behind it. They have claimed responsibility for it, but that's only rumor. There's no actual physical hard evidence and to suggest that. And there is suspicion that they have done that in retaliation for Ecuador's rescinding of internet access to the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange at their embassy in London. Certainly, there was a tweet by WikiLeaks founder saying, "Yep, you've made your point. Please re-enable the internet." Who knows? I mean, it could have been that. It could be a state-based actor trying to work out whether they've got enough power now to take down the whole internet. We just don't know at this point. And I'm sure, again, there'll be more data to come out of that attack, as time goes on and more postmortems are done. But certainly, Dyn being one of the largest players in that space. You know, being able to bring them down, which brought down places like Netflix and Spotify and Amazon and other bits and pieces. It's certainly of concern. I don't know if you've heard any other things in the market, Stuart, about that Dyn attack.
No, not at this point in time. I think obviously we'll get more news in the coming weeks. It'll be interesting to find out, obviously what happens with that botnet as well. Whether it continues to get used or whether it get fragmented now that the source code has been leaked, I would suspect that there'll be other hacker groups that are probably trying to figure out ways to take over the actual botnet or fragment it. So it'll be certainly interesting to see what happens in that space.
And it leads beautifully into our next discussion point, which is the manufacturer of a large amount of the cameras that were involved in that Mirai attack. So that Mirai botnet, it's malicious code. It's basically some software that goes out on the internet and it searches for devices that have been published on there. So whether it's a, you know, it's a, it could be a baby monitor, it could be a CCTV camera, it might be your router that you've got for your computer at home. And it basically tests to see if certain ports are open. And ports are just basically think of them as doors to your house. And it, goes to the front door and tries to unopen it. And if it's opened and unlocked, it tries to walk in. And then once it's in, it starts doing its own thing and installs its own software. And then it allows the guys that own the botnet and that run it to then provide instruction to that device. And the instruction was basically continually, send traffic to the Dyn site to try and bring it offline. And you get a collection of those devices all doing it. You basically use up so much bandwidth that you flood the capacity for a provider to actually, process the request, and therefore some packets get dropped and you go offline. Now, there has been a lot of discussion, and I think we've discussed this on a number of occasions, Stuart.
Yeah, I mean the recall that this manufacturer has actually made is probably more of a PR stunt at this point. The reality is that a lot of what they make is white labeled. In other words, other people are sticking their brands and names and stuff on it. So unless and of course the other thing is I don't think they have a database of customers because they're just selling to other people that are then selling them on with their own boxing and packaging and so on. So I think you'll find that this actually has very little impact on the actual botnet size because the vast majority of people are not even going to know what brand baby monitor camera they have. It's just stuck there and left and forgotten, or if it's a CC, some form of CCTV system, again, they're usually put in there and installed. And, some company will come in and install it, and then it's there and operates for 5, 10 years until it dies, and then they'll look at replacing it. So I don't think there's going to be a lot of, I don't think this is really going to have a lot of impact. The reality is that what needs to happen these days is that these devices need to be updatable over the air. So if they're going to be on the internet, they should just have an automatic update feature to them that keeps the firmware up to date and closes holes when they need to.
Which also
'Cause,
opens holes, though, too, right? Because if you compromise the update process.
yes, I mean, obviously that is a concern as well. But there are companies that do this securely and successfully, and there is obviously this is a I guess what I would call is a, it is a problem that has been solved in the sense of you can do a secure update process, you can certificate, you can have the communications encrypted, you can have the firmware signed by the manufacturer and have some kind of hard coding in there that only allows for a particular signature or some way of doing that. So, there are things that can be done that will just make this process so much more secure than what it is
But
today.
unfortunately, it
Will it be
costs money,
perfect?
right?
Well, the unfortunate thing is you can't go back and apply this now to all those millions of devices that are already out there.
Yeah, they've been compromised, and I think the big problem is whilst and I'm not even going to try and pronounce that name, Hangzhou
Hung,
Xiongmai.
it's probably Hangzhou Xiongmai.
Hongzhou. So, despite the fact that they have said, we realize that some of the products that we've sold are vulnerable and causing massive disruption, we're going to recall them, like you've identified. They're not going to have a database, so there's no way to contact them. And because they white label them, no one knows whether the chip in the device was manufactured by them. And they've not provided any way to identify it either. They haven't come out and said, "Well, look at your device," and or provided a list of devices. Well, we've sold to these particular manufacturers, so if you have a X brand, it's potential. And so I think you're right. I think the probability that even 10% of these devices are going to be returned is probably zero to none, I'd say.
Yeah, I would be shocked if there was more than about 5% returns, to be honest.
Yeah, and it's quite quite bad stuff, like hard-coded user credentials, the Telnet left enabled and SSH with no way to disable them in the actual web interface. Some of the devices even you can disable it, but when you power it off and power it on, it gets re-enabled.
Yeah.
So, I guess unfortunately, and we don't want to really be a throwaway society because, you know, it leads to waste. But in this instance, and I think it's something you've said on a number of occasions, you know, if it's a cheap product, it's likely you are the product. Throw it away and invest some money in a good quality, reputable brand.
Yeah, and there are some good brands out there that do this stuff right, and that's the thing, is that unfortunately they are more expensive, which is why there are millions of these things out there.
Yeah, exactly right. All right, so moving on, I guess we're at the fun part of the podcast, the good old news bite section, and we are very, very close to time, so I'm going to run through these really quickly, and it's all... It's mostly good news. So the first one was a hacker has been caught attempting to steal $1.5 million from the U.S. financial institution. Hacker Dwayne C. Hands has what would you call this? It's not social, because he posed as an authorized bank employee to conduct financial transactions on behalf of that institution, and then he duped corporate bank accounts into transferring money into his personal account, and finally he hacked the SAM.gov website and replaced the financial institution's bank account details with his own. The I guess the lighter side, or the interesting part of this is the money that he stole, he actually used it to invest in the stock market and real estate. So I guess he's recontributing back into the economy, right? I mean, he was able to steal $1.5 million, but the Justice Department was able to reverse the wire transfers. But he did get away with about $134,000, which was invested. So... I guess for the younger generation listening, crime doesn't pay. You'll get caught. And if you are going to steal it, investing it doesn't make you that much better. It's not a get out of jail free card.
Yeah, it's I mean, maybe if you donated it to a charity or something,
that's not the modern day Robin Hood. Moving on, we have a Indian, several people that have been charged with a Indian call center scam. Now, I don't know about you, Stuart, but in Australia, we get numerous calls at night while you're having dinner, you know, in the afternoons, on weekends and things, where they're just scammers. They're people calling you. They say, hey, you know, your computer's been infected with a virus and I've been called by Microsoft to try and fix it up for you. Or, you know, in this instance, it was a scam whereby people were calling. The number that they used was actually a legitimate number. So they obviously were faking the U.S. Immigration Service and Internal Revenue Service. And they'd call and say, hey, you haven't paid your outstanding taxes, even if you had paid them, and try to dupe them, threatening them with large penalties and arrests and things like that. And they successfully cheated 15,000 people out of over $250 million. And they kind of make the call and say, hey, you know, you've got $15,000 outstanding in tax, and you know, we're going to arrest you tomorrow unless you pay it right now. Do you have a credit card? Can you make a direct debit transfer? Things like that. It was a coordinated effort by US and Indian authorities. They made 61 arrests, including 21 from the US. And they were saying that the scammers in India were working in tandem with co-conspirators in the US. They'd first steal personal details from the victims off social media platforms, and then they'd make the calls. They had the US government caller ID. Obviously, people get freaked out, I guess, when they're threatened with large penalties, you know, whether it's monetary or jail time. And so a lot of people did actually, you know, fall for it, I guess, and you know, lost some money.
Yeah, this is a more sophisticated version than the ones I've seen, or I should say I've heard about in Australia. You know, my mother got called numerous times by... officials, or I shouldn't say officials, supposed employees of Microsoft, in India, saying that they detected her computer had been infected, and that she should download this program, and of course it was going to cost money, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, my having had this conversation numerous times with my mother, she always knew to, if she had any doubts, she'd always call me and say, this is what's just happened. What do you think? And I'd always just tell her, it's a scam. I think in one occasion she told me, "Oh, you should be ashamed of yourself." On the same note, I actually had my grandmother when she was still with us. She actually got called by the same group. We're a Microsoft customer service person. We've detected your computer has a virus on it. And of course, she didn't have a computer in the house. Didn't have an internet connection. So it was very easy to tell them where to go on that one.
So this is quite quite.
This is a bit more sophisticated. This is obviously they're doing some background, getting some information on the users, which of course makes the social engineering side a little bit what would I say, harder to or easier for them to actually succeed, because it does actually sound like that whoever's calling them actually has details on them, and so it probably makes it sound more realistic that they've been called by a government entity.
Yeah, and the whole going to the effort of faking the number too,
yeah.
just like you reversed it. Yeah. So I guess I don't know about Hong Kong, Stuart, or the US, but certainly in Australia, the tax office doesn't call. They will always communicate via post or the secure web portal. And even then, they generally always still send a written letter by via the post, signed and so forth. Never make an if you suspect it. Never make a transaction on the spot. Take their details down, get their name, get their ID, get their phone number, and then look up the actual, the particular department or company that they're talking about or pretending to be from, and give them a call, and say, "Hey,
Yeah.
I've had this call. What do you think?" And
What's the case number? You should be able to, all those kinds of things. So.
And otherwise, check with a friend. Certainly feel free to reach out to us. I mean, I get a few of those from my clients every now and then, and it takes me 3 seconds to look at it and say, "Yep, yeah, it's legitimate," or "No, it's not."
It's a scam. More often than not, it's a scam. I mean, we used to have clients contacting me quite often. It seems to have died down a bit over the domain name renewal scams, all that kind of stuff. So similar.
And the last couple of items, just a very, very quick one. There was a hackathon organized by the security company Trend Micro, a very popular antivirus software, in conjunction with the Tipping Point's 0 Day initiative. So that's a security initiative in the community that tries to reward, I guess, white hackers from for finding vulnerabilities and then reporting them. It's held in tandem again with PAXSEC West Security Conference, which is in Japan. And basically, the law of the land is contestants get 3 attempts, and each one lasts 5 minutes, and they've got to successfully demonstrate an exploit. And if they do and they win the contest, they get rewarded with some money. Keen Labs, which is a division of Tencent, won the contest and were named the Masters of Porn. Now, we've spoken about that a number of times. The company Tencent is very popular in Hong Kong, Stuart.
Oh yes, they're the makers of WeChat, and in fact, one of my alumni from Curtin University in Western Australia is actually the CFO of Tencent. So yes, I'm quite familiar with Tencent on a number of levels.
So yeah, very, very popular, and obviously they've got Keen Lab, which is a division of Tencent, and they specialize in security. And winning Master of Porn earned them a tidy $215,000 for the 3 exploits that they demonstrated. One was able to successfully install a rogue application onto a Google Nexus phone. One was able to install a rogue application onto an iPhone 6S. And the other one was able to successfully leak a photo from an iPhone. And I guess the highlights of this are the Google Nexus. They were still able to do that despite Google releasing the latest OS the night before they were actually going to present. So they stayed up all night to try and, you know, tweak the vulnerability to make sure it worked, and they were able to. The iPhone, whilst they were able to install an app on the iPhone, it didn't persist via post a reboot, so they did lose some money for that one. But yeah, nonetheless, it does go to show that A, you know, your devices are not secure. You need to still be very, very aware and have an awareness of it when you're using them. And B, that you know, you need to do your updates, because like these guys, you know, these are the good guys. These are the guys that are, you know, working out the vulnerabilities and then reporting them back to the vendors so that they can go and patch them. So if you install those patches, you know, again, you're securing your device against the latest vulnerabilities. So that was good. They didn't sell them on the dark web or you know, give them to a company that might potentially use them for harm rather than good.
Yeah, I mean, I guess one of my comments on this one was, you know, while obviously while all, you know, both the Google Nexus and the iPhone were both vulnerable, one of the interesting, I guess, follow-up comments to this was that Google had a patch for the flaw within 24 hours of the competition. So, you know, you can't certainly get much better in terms of a response than that. Obviously, from an Android perspective, you know, that's great if you have a Google Nexus phone. Unfortunately, less so if you're not running a Google Nexus and using one of the other flavors of Android, which is, you know, still a problem within the Android market space.
Mm-hmm. All right, Stuart, I think we'll wrap it up there, mate. We're once again over time, unless you've got any more comments on that one.
No, I think we can wrap it up here.
That covers off the major cybersecurity related events for the week. Thanks for listening. If you have any topics you would like us to cover, please feel free to contact either Stuart or myself. Until next week, stay safe. And Stuart?
This week, I'm going to say keep your devices updated.
Very good advice. And of course, don't reuse your passwords.